Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, for the past 11 years, the crew of Town Hall Seattle's Short Stories Live series has presented a celebration of storytelling they call A Rogue's Christmas. Curator Jean Sherrard chooses seasonally appropriate readings. It's always a festive, thought-provoking, and slightly devious gathering, just the thing to keep Christmas weird in Seattle. This year's readings include The Fruitcake Theory and Christmas in Qatar by Calvin Trillin, You Better Not Cry by Augustin Burroughs, Christmas Every Day by William Dean Howells, A Christmas Spectacle by Robert Benchley, Three Wise Guys by Sandra Cisneros, and Christmas Cracker by Jeanette Winterson. Taproot Theater hosted the event on December 10th. Sonia Harris recorded the proceedings. The readers include Paul Dorpat, Jean Sherrard, Kurt Beattie, Bill Ontiveros, and Marianne Owen. From all of us at Speakers Forum, best wishes for happy holidays and a healthy and prosperous 2018.
Well, our opening canticle is from Calvin Trillin, who's the beloved American humorist, journalist, novel, food writer, and poet. Now, he's also a notorious fruitcake hater. And he's inveighed against fruitcakes for decades. And here's an example from a little essay he calls The Fruitcake Theory. There's a family in Michigan I once read about that brings out an antique fruitcake every Christmas, a fruitcake that for some reason was not eaten at Christmas dinner in 1895. And has symbolized the holiday ever since. They put it on the table not as a dessert, but as something somewhere between an icon and a centerpiece. A very sensible way to use fruitcake. You mean you think that fruitcake would be dangerous to eat, you ask? Well, you wouldn't eat an antique. My Uncle Herbert used to chew on an old sideboard now and then, but we always considered that odd behavior. No, there's nothing dangerous about fruitcakes as long as people send them along without eating them. If people ever started eating them, I suppose there might be need for federal legislation. Well, how about people who buy fruitcakes by themselves? Well, now you mention it, if nobody in the history of the United States has ever bought a fruitcake for himself, people have bought turnips for themselves. People have bought any number of Brussels sprouts for themselves. But no one has ever bought a fruitcake for himself. That does tell you a little something about fruitcakes. Well, otherwise, and I have to confess, I am a lover of fruitcakes. Are there any fruitcake lovers here? Other than being a hater of fruitcakes, Trillin's a fine fellow. Born in 1954, Sandra Cisneros is best known for her brilliant coming-of-age novel, The House on Mango Street. And all of her writings draw from her life as the daughter of immigrants. She said that much of her youth was spent with her family in constant migration between Mexico and the United States, and that this gave her a sense that she was always straddling two countries, but not belonging in either culture. Those collisions have inspired and illuminated an extraordinary body of work. And here to read her splendid and moving story, The Three Wise Guys, is the legendary actor, writer, producer, stagehand, Bill Ontiveros.
Thanks a lot. The Three Wise Guys. The big box came marked, "Do not open till Xmas." But the mama said, "Not until the day of the three kings. Not until Dios Los Reyes, the 6th of January. Do you hear? That's what the mama said exactly." Only she said it all in Spanish. Because in Mexico, where she was raised, it is custom for boys and girls to receive their presents on January 6th and not Christmas. Even though they were living on the Texas side of the river now, not until January 6th. Yesterday, the mama had risen in the dark, same as always, to reheat the coffee in a tin saucepan and warm the breakfast tortillas. The papa got up, coughing and spitting up the night, complaining how the evening before, the buzzing of the chicharras insects kept him from sleeping. By the time the mama had the house smelling of oatmeal and cinnamon, the papa would be gone to the fields, the sun already tangled in the trees, and the ucaras, black and white birds, screeching their rubbery screech cry. The boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda would have to be shaken awake for school. The mama would give the baby Gilberto his bottle, and then she would go back to sleep before getting up again to the chores that were always waiting. This is how the world had been. But today, the big box had arrived. When the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda came home from school, it was already sitting in the living room, in the front room, in the front of the television set that no longer worked. Who had put it there? Where had it come from? A box covered with red paper and green Christmas trees and a card on the top that simply said, "Merry Christmas to the Gonzalez family, Frank, Earl, Dwight, and Dwight Travis. P.S. Do not open till Xmas." That's all. 2 times the mama was made to come into the living room, first to explain to the children and then later to the father how the brothers Travis had arrived in the blue pickup and how they had taken all three of those big men to lift the box out of the truck and bring it inside, and how she had had to stand there and say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you," over and over again, because those are the only words that she knew in English. Then the brothers Travis had nodded as well. The way they always did when they came and they brought boxes of clothes or the turkey each November or the canned ham on Easter. Ever since the children had begun to earn high grades at the school where Dwight Travis was principal. But this year, the Christmas box was bigger than usual. What could be in a box so big? The boy Ruben and the girl Rosalina begged all afternoon to be allowed to open it. And this is when the mama had said, "The 6th of January, the day of the three kings, not a day sooner." It seemed the weeks stretched themselves wider and wider since the arrival of the big box. The mama got used to sweeping around it because it was so heavy, it's hard for her to push into the corner. But since the television no longer worked, ever since the afternoon that the children had poured iced tea through the little grates in the back, it really didn't matter if the box obstructed the views. Visitors came inside the house, were told and told again the stories of how the big box had arrived. And then each was made to guess what was inside. It was the comadre Elodia who suggested over coffee one afternoon that the big box held a portable washing machine that could be rolled away when not in use, the kind that she'd seen in her Sears Roebuck catalog. The mama said she hoped so because the Ringer washer that she had used for the last 10 years had finally gotten tired and quit. These past few weeks, she had had to boil all the clothes in a big pot she used for cooking the Christmas tamales. Yes, she had hoped the big box was a portable washing machine. A washing machine, even a portable one, would be good. But the neighbor man, Gaetano, said, "What foolishness, comadre! Can't you see the box is too small to hold a washing machine? Even a portable one?" "Most likely, God has heard your prayers and sent a new color TV.
With a good antenna, you could catch the Mexican soap operas, the neighbor man said. You could distract yourselves with the complicated troubles of the rich and give thanks to God for the blessed simplicity of your poverty. A new TV would surely be the answers to all your miseries. Each night, when the papa came home from the fields, he would spread newspapers on the cot in the living room where the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalina slept and sit facing the big box in the center of the room. Each night, he imagined the box held something different. The day before, yesterday, he guessed a new record player. Yesterday, an ice chest filled with beer. Today, the papa sat with his bottle of beer, fanning himself with a magazine, and said, in a voice as much as a plea as a prophecy,
air conditioner.
But the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalina were sure the big box was filled with toys. They'd even punctured it in the corner with a pencil when their mother wasn't looking and she was busy cooking. But they could only see nothing but blackness. Only the baby Gilberto remained uninterested in the contents of the big box and seemed more interested every day and more fascinated with the exterior of the box rather than the interior. One afternoon, he tore off a fistful of paper, which he was chewing, when his mother swooped him up with one arm, rushed him into the kitchen sink, and forced him to swallow handfuls of lukewarm water in case the red dye of the wrapping paper might be poisonous. When Christmas Eve finally came, the Gonzalez family put on their clothes and went to midnight mass. And when they came home, the house smelled of tamales and atole, a warm drink, and everyone was allowed to open one present before going to sleep. But the big box was to remain untouched until the 6th of January. On New Year's Eve, the house was filled with people, related some not, coming in, out. Friends of the papa came with bottles. The mama set out a bowl of grapes to count off the New Year's. The young children did not sleep in the living room cot as they normally did, but in the living room was crowded with fat-fannied ladies and fat-bellied stomachs sashaying to the accordion music of the midget twins from McAllen. Instead, the children fell asleep on a lump of handbags and crumpled suit jackets on top of the mama and papa's bed, dreaming of the contents of the big box. Finally, the 5th of January, and the boy Ruben and the girl Rosalinda could hardly sleep, and all night long they whispered last-minute wishes. The boy thought perhaps if the box held a bicycle, he would be the first to ride it, since he was the oldest. This made his sister cry, until the mama had to yell from her bedroom on the other side of the plastic curtains, "Be quiet, or I'm going to give each one of you the stick," which sounds worse in Spanish than it does in English. Then, no one said anything, and after a long time, long after they heard the mama's piped wheezing and the papa's pipe snoring, the children closed their eyes and remembered nothing. The papa was already in the bathroom, copping up the night before when his throat was clearing up, and then the Eucharist began their clownish chirping. The boy Ruben shook his sister. The mama was frying potatoes and beans for breakfast, nodded permission for the box to be open. With a kitchen knife, The boy Ruben cut carefully along the edge of the top. The girl Rosalinda tore the Christmas wrappings with her fingernails. The papa and the mama lifted the cardboard flaps, and everyone peered inside to see what it was the brothers Travis had brought them on Christmas, had brought them on the Day of the Three Kings. There were layers of bald newspapers packed on top, and when these had been cleared away, the boy Ruben looked inside. The girl Rosalinda looked inside. The papa and the mama looked, and this is what they saw. The complete Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. 24 volumes in red imitation leather with gold embossed letters, beginning with volume 1, Arbel, and ending with volume 24, Yel Zin. The girl Rosalina let out a sad cry, as if her hair was going to be cut. The boy Ruben pulled out volume 6, Bid Fem. There were many pictures and many words, but there were many more words than pictures. The papa flipped through volume 22, but because he could not read English words, simply put the book back and grunted, what can I do with these? No one said anything. And shortly after, the screen door slammed. Only the mama knew what to do with the contents of the big box. She withdrew volume 6, 7, and 8, and marched off to the dinette set in the kitchen, placed 2 on top of Rosalinda's chair so that she could better reach the table, and put 1 underneath the plant stand that danced. When the boy and the girl returned from school that day, they found the books stacked into squat pillars against one living room wall and a board placed on top. On this were arranged several plastic doilies and framed family pictures. The rest of the volumes, the baby Gilberto was playing with. He had already rubbing his sore gums against the corners of volume 14. The girl Rosalinda grew interested in the books, and she took out her colored pencils and painted blue on the eyelids of the illustrations of the women, and with red pencil dipped in spit, she painted their lips and fingernails red. After a couple of days, when the pictures of the women had all been colored in this manner, she began to cut out some of the prettier pictures and paste them on loose leaf paper. Only one volume suffered from being exposed to the rain when the papa improvised a hat during a sudden shower. He forgot it on the hood of the car, and when he drove off, when the children came home from school, they set it on the porch to dry. But the pages puffed up so, became so fat, the book was impossible to close. Only the boy, Ruben, refused to touch the books, and for several days he avoided the principal because he didn't know what to say in case Mr. Travis was to ask him how he was enjoying the Christmas present. On the Saturday after New Year's, the mama and the papa went to town for groceries and left the boy in charge of watching his sister and baby brother. The girl Rosalinda was stacking books into a spiral staircase and making her dolls descend them in a very fancy manner. Perhaps the boy Ruben would have not bothered to open the volume left on the kitchen table if he had not seen his mother wedge her namesake corsage in its pages. And on the page where the mama's carnation lay pressed between 2 pieces of Kleenex was a picture of a dog in a spaceship. First dog in space, the caption read. The boy turned to another page and read where cashews came from, and then about the man who invented the guillotine, and then about Bengal tigers, and about clouds, and all afternoon the boy read. And even when the mama and the papa came home, even after the sun set, until the mama said, "Time to sleep," and put the light out. In their bed, on the other side of the plastic curtain, the mama and the papa slept. Across from them in the crib slept the baby Gilberto. The girl Rosalinda slept on her end of the cot. But the boy Ruben watched the night sky turn from violet to blue to gray, and then from gray to blue to violet once again.
Time for a little Robert Benchley. Now, he lived between 1887 and 1945. And when he was my age, he'd been dead for 4 years. So he's best known for his deliciously funny contributions to The New Yorker. And he wrote this next little gem, which captures the lunacy of a Sunday school pageant in which mishaps, miscues, and memory lapses abound. So let's bring back Kurt Beatty to read this to us.
Thanks. A Christmas Spectacle by Robert Benchley. For use in Christmas Eve entertainments in the vestry. At the opening of the entertainment, the superintendent will step into the footlights, recover his balance apologetically, and say, "Boys and girls of the intermediate department, friends and parents, I suppose you all know why we are here tonight." At this point, the audience will titter apprehensively. "Mrs. Drury and her class of little girls have been working very hard to make this entertainment a success, and I am sure that everyone here tonight is going to have what I overheard one of my boys the other day calling some good time." Indulgent laughter from the little boys. "And may I add, before the curtain goes up, that immediately after the entertainment, we want you all to file into the Christian Endeavor Room, where there will be a Christmas tree with all the fixins, as the boys say. Shrill whistling from the little boys and immoderate applause from everyone." "There will then be a wait of 25 minutes, while sounds of hammering and dropping may be heard from behind the curtains. The Boys' Club Orchestra will render the Poet and Peasant Overture 4 times in succession, each time differently. At last, one side of the curtains will be drawn back, the other will catch on something and have to be released by hand. Someone will whisper loudly, 'Put out the lights,' following which the entire house will be plunged into darkness. Amid catcalls from the little boys, the footlights will at last go on disclosing the windows in the rear of the vestry, rather ineffectively concealed by a group of small fir trees on standards, one of which has already fallen over, leaving exposed a corner of the map of Palestine and the list of Gold Star classes for November. In the center of the stage is a larger tree, undecorated, while at the extreme left, invisible to everyone in the audience except those sitting at the extreme right, is an imitation fireplace leaning against the wall. 25 seconds too early, little Flora Rochester will prance out from the wings, uttering the first shrill notes of a song, and will have to be grabbed by eager hands and pulled back. 24 seconds later, the piano will begin The Return of the Reindeer with a powerful accent on the first note of each bar. And Flora Rochester, Lillian McNulty, Gertrude Hamilton, and Martha Ristall will swirl on, dressed in white, and advance heavily into the footlights, which will go out. There will then be an interlude while Mr. Neff, the sexton, adjusts the connection, during which the four little girls stand undecided whether to brave it out or to cry. As a compromise, they giggle and are herded back into the wings by Mrs. Drury amid applause. While the lights go on again, the applause becomes deafening, and as Mr. Neff walks triumphantly away, the little boys in the audience will whistle, there she goes, all dressed up in her Sunday clothes. The Return of the Reindeer will be started again, and the showgirls will reappear, this time more gingerly and somewhat dispirited. They will, however, sing the following to the music of the ballet Pizzicato from Sylvia. We greet you, on this Christmas Eve so fine. We greet you, and we wish you a good time. They will then turn towards the tree, and Flora Rochester will advance, hanging a silver star on one of the branches, meanwhile reciting a verse, the only distinguishable words of which are, I am faith so strong and pure. At the conclusion of her recitation, the star will fall off. Lillian McNulty will then step forward and hang her star on a branch, reading her lines in clear tones. And I am hope, the virtue great, my gift to Christmas now I make, that children and grown-ups may hope today that tomorrow will be a merry Christmas day. The hanging of the third star will be consummated by Gertrude Hamilton, who will get as far as sweet charity I bring to place upon the tree, at which point the strain will become too great and she will forget the remainder. After several frantic glances towards the wings, from which Mrs. Drury is sending out whispered messages to the effect that the next line begins, my message bright, Gertrude will disappear, crying softly. After the morale of the cast has been in some measure restored by the pianist, who, with great presence of mind, will play a few bars of Will There Be Any Stars in My Crown to cover up Gertrude's exit, Martha Rist will unleash a rope of silver tinsel from the foot of the tree and, stringing it out over the boughs as she skips around in a circle, will say with great assurance, Round and round the tree I go, through the holly and the snow, bringing love and Christmas cheer through the happy year to come. At this point, there will be a great commotion and jangling of sleigh bells offstage, and Mr. Creamer, rather poorly disguised as Santa Claus, will emerge from the opening in the imitation fireplace. A great popular demonstration for Mr. Creamer will follow. He will then advance to the footlights and, rubbing his pillow and ducking his knees to denote joviality, will say thickly through his false beard, well, what have we here? A lot of bad little boys and girls who aren't going to get any Christmas presents this year? Nervous laughter from the little boys and girls. Let me see. I have a note here from Dr. Whidden. Let's see what it says. Reads from a paper on which there is obviously nothing written. If you and the young people of the intermediate department will come into the Christian Endeavor Room, I think we may have a little surprise for you. Well, what do you suppose it can be? Cries of, I know, from sophisticated ones in the audience. Maybe it is a bottle of castor oil. Raucous cheers from the little boys and elaborately simulated disgust on the part of the little girls. Well, anyway, suppose we go out and see. Now, if Miss Liftnagel will oblige us with a little march on the piano, we will all form in a single line. At this point, there will ensue a stampede towards the Christian Endeavor Room in which chairs will be broken, decorations demolished, and the protesting Mr. Creamer badly hurt. This will bring to a close the first part of the entertainment.
Thank you, Kurt. Well, the last story tonight is by one of our favorite writers, and it will be performed by one of our favorite actors. Jeanette Witterson found great acclaim with, and many of you may know this book, which was adapted, by, I think, by the BBC into a television series, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And then she came out a while later with Sexing the Cherry. Her most recent collection of short stories only came out last Christmas, so it's almost exactly a year since they were released, and they're called Christmas Days, in which she's collected together a dozen stories that she's written over the years around this time of year for friends and fans, and with each story she includes a recipe. I highly recommend it. It's delicious in a number of ways, but as a kind of benediction, let me read from her epilogue to this book of short stories. At Christmas, I think about the Christmas story and all the Christmas stories since. As a writer, I know that we get along badly without space in our lives for imagination and reflection. Religious festivals were designed to be time outside of time. Time where ordinary time was subject to significant time. What we remember and what we invent. So light a candle to the dead, and light a candle to miracles, however unlikely, and pray that you recognize yours, and light a candle to the living, the world of friendship and family that means so much, and light a candle to the future, that it may happen and not be swallowed up by darkness, and light a candle to love. Lucky love. Her story, Christmas Cracker, is one of my favorites in this collection. And by the way, in Britain, a Christmas cracker is, many of you may know, it's a decorated cardboard tube, and which you two people take hold of each end and pull it apart, and in the middle there pops out bonbons and treats and a special prize. And here to read this little marvel for us is an actor who's a Seattle institution, who's graced our stages for many years, the remarkable Marianne Owen.
Christmas Cracker by Jeanette Witterson. Christmas Eve at the Cracker Factory. Boxes labeled trumpets, drums, stars, robins, and snowmen were stacked on either side of the long tables where the crackers were assembled. Sheets of gold cardboard were piled against the cutting machines. Waterfalls of red streamers ran down the walls. The spitting, snapping, banging, firing pistol shot strips that made the crackers crack were safely in tubes on the shelves. Three giant vats of the Alibaba kind, marked hats, jokes, and balloons, sat under the funnels that automatically topped them up as more and more crackers were filled, packed, and dispatched. The cracker factory operated all year round, but at Christmas time, everybody worked harder to fulfill the orders. Cheap crackers, economy crackers, family packs, deluxe boxes, sets for children, sets for grown-ups, and some boxes marked adult because they contained very tiny briefs. Most of the crackers had long since been dispatched to stores and from stores to tables as everyone made ready for Christmas Day. But there was one cracker left to be made. The very last, the very special, the giant charity Christmas cracker, long as a crocodile, fat as a pudding, an enormous golden tube lying on its side, waiting to be stuffed tight as a sausage. But for now, the factory is empty because it's early morning. The bus is just arriving at the gates, and Bill and Fred and Amy and Belle are coming in, special shift, cheerful because it's Christmas now, and they'll have a drink when they're done. The factory is empty. Or is it? The dog is still asleep in a dream of warm tissue paper where he crept last night, cold and wet because somebody left open a small window and he's only a small dog. In he crept under the red safety light that shone on the gold card beneath the paper angels. He rolled on his back to get dry and ate a marzipan donkey, bad for his teeth, but what can you do, and fell asleep. In they come, neon lights, radio on, and before the dog can say woof, a golden tunnel opens right before his brown eyes, and a pair of firm, spade-like hands shoves all the tissue paper and all the dog right inside one end of the cracker and seals it with a plastic lid. He can still see the other end. He buries his nose deeper, the hair on his ears twitching as an avalanche of chocolates crashes round his head, followed by an army of teddy bears, an arsenal of pop guns, a barrage of balloons, beads like hailstones, a string of yo-yos, a peal of whistles, a masked ball of false noses and beards, a plague of clockwork mice, and a huddle of evil-looking finger puppets dressed in black. Somebody says, "Make it go with the explosive, then. This one has to go with a bang." A fuse rod of gunpowdery stuff is poked past the dog's nose, sneeze, and past his tail, twitch, and out through a hole in the end. The dog thinks of all those circus animals fired out of cannons, or the ones dropped by parachute behind enemy lines. He thinks of Laika, the Soviet dog shot into space, never to come down. And he thinks of the star dogs, Canis Major and Minor, tracking the dark fields above, glittering guardians of their rougher kind below. Perhaps he's going to join them. Sky set, a new burned star, Canis Fugit, the flying dog. But he doesn't want to be a flying dog. He wants all four paws on the ground. Too late. They're tying the ribbon at both ends round the giant charity Christmas cracker. He feels himself being lifted up and carried out like a canine Cleopatra in a roll of carpet. And there he is on a gilded barge. No, it's the back of a battered truck, driving towards a large hotel with a green-coated doorman at the door and a white Christmas tree behind the door in a chandeliered lobby. The dog and his cracker are carried in by specially chosen elves on the minimum wage, to the wonderment and applause of all. This is the children's charity party. Rich parents have paid a lot so that their children can help children in need without having to meet any of them. The dog can hear announcements being made, special prizes, and the best prize of all is for the one who wins the cracker. The dog is worried about what will happen when they find him wrapped inside. He isn't anyone's idea of a free gift, not anyone's idea of a gift at all. He's a stray. He knows no one will want him. He lives in the park and drinks from the fountain. He came with the fair when he was a puppy and ran round the rides in his crisscrossed mongrel colors until one day the fair packed up and the caravans pulled away one by one, and he went to sleep for a bit because he didn't know what was happening, and when he woke up, everyone had gone. He ran sniffing around after them at first, following the scent of diesel and hot dogs, but his paws were slower than their wheels, and though he ran and ran till his pads were raw, at nighttime, he had to give up, and limping and frightened through the dark and noise, he found his way back to the park. He was glad of the rustle of the trees and the soft leaves. Sometimes people feed him sandwiches, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they try to catch him. He knows the sound of the van, and he runs down the street where he can slither under a gate until they've gone. Sometimes a human being sleeps in the park and makes a fuss of him, but the humans move on. You can't rely on people. He knows that. Last night was very cold. He was out scavenging for food. The kebab man had gone back to Turkey for Christmas. The dog likes kebabs. He sniffed a bit round the bins, but the streets had been cleaned for Christmas. As he trotted down the road, keeping to the wall, he saw a window ajar and a red light inside. It looked warm. The rain had turned to sleet. But now, what will happen when they find him in the cracker? He can hear a lot of noise. He'll keep quiet. The hotel ballroom is crammed with children waving raffle tickets. It's time for the prizes to be given away. Dolls, games, toy guitars, remote control cars. There's a man in a spangly jacket with a microphone. He's on the stage, and he wants the children to sing Jingle Bells. Then it's time. The big one, the cracker. The elves push it on stage. What's the winning number? Yes, it's 999. Two children rush forward, a fat boy in a red Elvis suit and a slim girl in a fake fur coat. Has there been a mistake? There are two winning tickets. The children glare at each other and take up combat positions on either side of the cracker. The room fills with feral energy as the kids in the room take sides. Pull! 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 The fat boy wraps his fat hands round one end, and the slim girl digs her heels in and just holds on like she's seen her mother do in the sales. But then, a pale, quiet boy comes forward and gives the master of ceremonies his ticket. He's got 9992. The master of ceremonies scratches his wig. Whatever is in this bumper, giant, gigantically exciting cracker, you'll just have to share. The children in the ballroom, boo! Sharing is for suckers, says the slim girl. It's Christmas, says the master of ceremonies, as though repeating the obvious will make the unexpected happen. The pale, quiet boy stands back while the boy in the red suit turns redder than his suit as he pulls and pulls at his end of the cracker. The girl throws her whole body weight on top of the cracker to stop her new enemy, the fat boy, winning the bang. The pale, quiet boy standing in the middle, holding his ticket, wonders why he can see a paw beginning to poke through the rip. Bang! There it goes, like somebody split the atom, and up in the air is a mushroom cloud made of chocolate and yo-yos and false noses and finger puppets, and for a second, it hangs in perfect space. Then, as the contents of the cracker scatter over the ballroom, it's every child for himself, fighting over silver coins and plastic spiders. And nobody notices that free falling back through the smoky acrid air is a small terrier with a paper hat round its neck. Where's the big present? Demands the fat boy. I won the cracker. I want the big present. The dog lands at his feet. What's that dog doing in the cracker? Shouts the slim girl. The dog is used to being chased and shouted at, but this time he knows he is in trouble. So he thinks on his feet, all four, as fast as his doggy brain can, and says, Hi! I'm a magic dog, like the genie in the bottle. What genie? What bottle? Says the fat boy, suspicious that he's missing something. Who stole my genie? If you're a magic dog, yeah, right. Where are my three wishes? Says the slim girl. The pale, quiet boy says nothing. He's looking at the dog. Okay, one wish each, says the dog, pointing at the children with his snouty nose. One, two, three. Your wish is my command. I want a Ferrari, shouts the fat boy. Righto, says the dog. Give me 10 minutes. The dog dives under the long tablecloth and races to the end of the ballroom. He's thinking only of escape. He skids across the polished floor, over the carpet, past the cloakroom, sees the zigzag sign for the emergency stairs, and reckons this must be for him. This is an emergency. Go, dog, go. He helter-skelters down the narrow concrete stairs and lands on his head in the underground car park. Move that Ferrari and buy 16, will ya? Shouts the valet, winging the keys through the air towards his assistant. And it must be said that for all our planning and plotting and deliberating and deciding, the moment that changes everything comes when it will, and cannot be coaxed or invoked, and should not be missed. The dog didn't miss. He stood on his hind paws and leapt. He leapt out of his scraggy, raggy tooth and nail past and caught the future as it whipped by his jaws. There he is, back up the whirl of concrete stairs, through the emergency exit, past the cloakroom, into the ballroom, just escaping concussion from 100 yo-yos. But with one bound, he's on the stage by the remains of the exploded cracker, and there are the car keys at the feet of the fat boy in the Elvis suit. Underground parking by 16, says the dog. The fat boy's eyes gleam with greedy happiness. He doesn't bother to thank the dog, just grabs the keys in his fat fist and waddles off, shoving the smaller children out of his way. Me now, orders the thin girl. Me, I want a real fur coat. Oh, that's unethical, replies the dog, who's never heard the word before but finds it on the tip of his pink tongue. I want one, shrieks the girl with such force that all the glass baubles on the Christmas tree shatter to powder. Okay, says the dog, your wish is my command. He's about to turn tail, but the pale little boy has knelt down and given him a drink of water and a ham sandwich, from which he's carefully removed the lettuce. The dog is grateful and hopes that whatever happens, he can bring the little boy his wish, but first there is the matter of the fur coat. He's lucky, because the parents are arriving to collect their children just at the moment when gentle tinsel snow begins to fall in the bar next to the ballroom, and wouldn't a drink be nice? And what's 5 minutes and a lifetime, especially at Christmas? But these are the minutes some good angel has earmarked for the dog, who can't believe his soft brown eyes as coat after coat is passed over to the girls working in the padded cloakroom. And if he just sits quietly and just waits, yes, it's a mink. The girls are busy hanging up the coats in the piles and chatting about best value turkeys, so they never notice the mink silently sliding away under the counter and across the floor, dog underneath it, 20 times his size, but he's a terrier and born with the holy law of the jaw. Don't let go. Darling, there's a coat running across the floor on its own, says one very drunk man to his very sober wife. She doesn't even look around. Don't be silly, darling. And so, the sleek mink coat, piloted by the rough-coated dog, makes its way across the carpet, into the ballroom, and towards the bottom of the steps of the stage. There's a muffled woof! The girl on her mobile phone doesn't notice that her heart's desire has arrived. The pale little boy has been waiting, really a bit anxious about the magic dog, and when he sees the coat, like a rug on centipede legs, slinking across the floor, he knows the dog must be underneath and runs to pull him out. Are you all right? Asks the boy. Bit hot, says the dog. Tell her, the coat's here. The girl
covers her face in her hands, then starts clapping the way she's seen winners do on TV talent shows. She pulls on the coat and sashays off the stage and falls flat on her face, just as the master of ceremonies reappears with a microphone in his hand. He looks grim. He looks serious. It seems that the winning ticket, 999, has not been multiplied by 3 after all. It wasn't the Christmas elves. It was 2 felt tip pens. The holders of ticket numbers 9 and 99 each added the required 9s to their stock. The big present will go to the real number 999 only. The pale little boy still has his ticket in his hand. The master of ceremonies examines it through a magnifying glass. Yes, it's the one, the organ. The organ strikes up jingle bells, but not loud enough to drown out a terrific crash in the hotel lobby. Everyone runs to the door to see a red Ferrari driven by the red-faced boy in a red suit stalled in a shatter of plate glass with a white Christmas tree jammed through the sunroof and a green doorman sprawled over the bonnet. The dog made me do it, screams the boy as the security guards drag him out. The girl in the fur coat is laughing so much she can hardly hold her phone still enough to take a snap to send to all her friends. As she holds both hands above her head, a pair of handcuffs slot securely round her wrists. That girl has stolen my coat. She's wearing it. A Russian model is unhappy. I am a friend of President Putin. The dog gave it to me, wails the girl. Arrest the dog! But the dog is nowhere to be seen. The dog has crept behind the blow-up reindeer in the ballroom, and he's not coming out. As the row in the hotel lobby reaches custard pie proportions, the master of ceremonies takes the pale, quiet boy to the gold box with the red ribbon and tells him to open it. Hesitatingly, the boy pulls the ribbon because he isn't used to big presents. He and his mother don't have much money. Inside the box is a mountain bike. And it's all yours, says the master of ceremonies. You won it fair and square. Left alone with the bike, the boy runs his hands over the clean cogs and smooth gears, the lightweight frame and the drop raise handlebars. It's the best bike in the world. Well, you won't be needing a wish then, says the dog invisibly from behind the blow-up reindeers. Probably for the best under the circumstances. Another shriek comes from the hotel lobby as the Ferrari owner is reunited with the remains of his car. He's shouting something about a golf course and Donald Trump. The boy sits on the edge of the stage, swinging his thin legs and looking at the dog's eyes, looking at him. He holds out another sandwich. The dog's brown eyes dart left, then right. Then he trots out, takes the sandwich, and sits next to the boy. I'm not a magic dog, says the dog. I must try. I got trapped in that cracker. It was so cold last night, and I usually sleep under the wheelie bins in the park, but they've taken them away. I was shivering. So I went for a walk to get warm, and I saw a light in a window, and I found a bench full of colored paper and fell asleep, and, well, here I am. I came on the bus, said the boy. I live with me mum. She cleans at the hotel, so they have to invite me to the party. What were you going to ask for, said the dog, if I'd been a magic dog? The boy thought for a bit, because he was that kind of boy. Then he said, if I had a wish, my wish would be to take you home with me and keep you forever. What?
barked the dog, his ears going round and round like satellite dishes picking up an alien signal. Whoop, woof, whoop, woof, whoop, woof. I'd wish for you, said the boy. My name's Tommy. What's yours? I haven't got one. Then I'll call you Magic, said Tommy. And Tommy asked his mother if he could take Magic home, and she said yes. He could keep the dog as long as he knew that a dog is forever and not just for Christmas. That was all right, because Tommy was a forever sort of boy. Then Tommy and Magic ran round and round and helped Tommy's mum to collect the streamers and burst balloons and all the things that Christmas leaves behind. And they were happy because they weren't leaving behind each other. At last, Tommy's mother finished work and off they went. All three into the frosty streets to the bus stop. The dog trotted beside the boy and looked into the clear sky at the star dogs. Cold and fine, and he knew that whatever you wish, you can't wish for better than love.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Town Hall Seattle's Short Stories Live series presented A Rogue's Christmas from Taproot Theater. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon. Good night and happy holidays.